issues of racial justice involve all people, white and people of color. That means considering the systems that have benefited white people for generations and how and why we should change them. Our guests are two authors, both white, who consider different aspects of reconciling the past. One explores what it's like to acknowledge white supremacists in the family tree. The other explains how racism pervades some modern American Christian teaching. Edward Ball has written 6 books, including topics like families and race. His most recent is called Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. And Robert P. Jones founded and leads the Public Religion Research Institute. He wrote the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. I spoke with them as part of this year's virtual Wisconsin Book Festival. Here's part of our conversation from October. Robert, we're 21 pages into your book when you call Christian teaching racist. Some people might think, yep, absolutely. And there are other people who are going to read your book and maybe get a little bit defensive about that. Why do you use the word racist to describe Christianity?
Yeah, well, you know, the word racist, I mean, and right there in the title of the book is the word white supremacy, right? Another word that I think many people recoil, from. And I think there is a kind of defensive reaction, I think, particularly from white Christians that might say, wait a minute, that's not me, that has nothing to do with me. And when they think of that, they think of, yeah, people in white robes and sheets and burning crosses and then distance themselves from that. But, you know, I think one of the things that I try to kind of write about in the book as honestly as I can is how close to us today assumptions that we think weren't there really were. And this basic assumption that whites were a superior race to non-white people in the world and in the country was an uncontroversial claim through most of the country's history and through most of Christianity's history. And undergirding that claim in the country was Christianity as the dominant religious and moral force in the country and in the dominant expression of religion. So the strongest way to legitimize a worldview is to connect it to a divine ordering of the universe. And that's exactly the role that Christianity played through most of American history, was to kind of take what was really an uncontroversial view among most whites, that whites were a superior race, and to wrap that in kind of a Christian theological cloak and connect it really to the way that God created the world.
You say Christian teachings include the idea that white people are by nature different, by nature above people of color. How did people of Christian faith reconcile that? How do people do it now?
Yeah, well, you know, it's remarkable how recently this was just explicit. I mean, I think to our modern ear today, for many people, it sounds very odd to even say that. But, you know, in my home state of Mississippi, so I grew up as a Southern Baptist in Jackson, Mississippi, for the most part. And then my family is 6 generations back from Middle Georgia and in and around Macon, Georgia. But, you know, even as late as 1960, for example, Ross Barnett was running for governor of Mississippi, and he would on the stump give a Christian defense of segregation. And he would literally say, as a regular part of his stump speech, God was the original segregationist, right? That was a line right out of his stump speech. And when he was elected governor, the tallest steeple church in the state, First Baptist Church of Jackson, Mississippi, held a special consecration service for him after he had run on this explicitly racist segregationist platform and put a Christian blessing on him as he went into office. So it wasn't that far back there that it's there today. What I show in the book is that it's not just historical, but even in public opinion data today, you can look at the views of white Christians and they look significantly different. That is, they hold more racist attitudes than whites who are not Christian. It's a real dividing line in the culture today. So you could still see this legacy creeping its way forward into the present. It's not just way back there.
Let's talk about that, because Edward, to one of the points you make in your book, it's very clear that this is not something of the past. There are elements of it that we've let go of, but white supremacy and these ideas are very much alive today.
Well, I think they are. I think that white supremacy has been a founding thesis of our national life. I describe it as an underground river that runs through the course of American history. It waters the roots of our institutions. White supremacy feeds the aquifers of our culture, and it remains underground, but occasionally it erupts in geysers of violence, in massacres, in widespread assaults on people of color. And then it returns, the geysers subside, and it returns to the underground of our cultural life. And what I do in this book, Life of a Klansman, is try to tell an origin story for white supremacy, how it inhabits, how it comes to inhabit the minds and mentality and routines of a single family, and how it becomes part of the atmosphere that's breathed in and out by a small group of people who become involved with the Ku Klux Klan. That's the smaller version of the bigger story that Robert is telling.
Your book centers around this direct ancestor of yours who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And you write, my predecessor, and you write, our Klansman. Why do you go so far as to choose those first person possessives? You take ownership.
Well, yes, I think it's important to try to take ownership of, you know, one's familial inheritance, good and bad. Most people who do family history prefer to take ownership of things in their ancestral past that flatter them. For example, to study the lives of people who were rich or people who were prominent in their communities. But if you think about it, quite a lot of us have ancestors who were involved in criminal activity. And in this case, in Klan activity. I have an ancestor. His name was Constant Lecorne. In Louisiana, in New Orleans, my grandmother's grandfather in New Orleans, who was a participant in the first generation of the Ku Klux during the years after the Civil War. And everybody in our family knows this, has known it for generations. But I wanted to look at it more carefully and try to tell the story of this one man as a way of understanding the mechanisms of white supremacy in a family context.
Edward, early in your book, you have this incredible description of a dinner table. And you describe it, it's cherry wood with a scalloped pedestal, the feet are like claws. And you write this, in a manner of speaking, we ate with our Klansmen 1,000 times. What do you mean?
Well, it has to do with taking ownership, as you characterized it a moment ago. This Klansman was a carpenter, and among his possessions, apparently, was a dinner set that came down to the hands of my mother, and was the dinner table at which our family ate 1,000 times. People in one's family life who might have been involved in white supremacist activity are not that far distant.
Robbie, how important is this idea of learning, of knowing not just in general, but really specifically about our own families?
You know, I think it's vitally important. And it's really about telling a truer story, right, about who we are and by virtue of that, how we got to where we are. I mean, I think we look around today, and if you ask, you know, gosh, why all the racial tension? Why all the strife around, you know, issues of race and racial justice? Well, there's a fairly simple story for that, but it's one that we don't know very well. I think that particularly for whites and white Christians have kind of suppressed, you know, this history. And I had a very similar, you know, experience kind of looking through my own family's, you know, archival stuff. I have inherited my mother's family Bible from 1815. And, you know, it tells the story of Pleasant Moon. He was a British, you know, immigrant to first to Virginia, then down to Georgia. And if I tell my own family story, just real quickly, there'd be one way I could tell it is Pleasant Moon was a foot soldier in the Revolutionary War, right? It's a very patriotic way of telling the story. He came and homesteaded in Georgia on a 200-acre farm, staked out a claim. And, you know, that's the story that I kind of knew. But there's another way to tell the story. That is, Pleasant Moon won a land lottery to get 200 free acres of land in Georgia. Where did that land come from? It came from the Cherokee Indians, Native Americans, who had been forcibly cleared off that land by the federal government. And then it was carved into nice, neat little squares of 200 acres to give away to white settlers. And even for him, who was a not wealthy, basically kind of, we would call him like lower working class, a little bit more than subsistence farmer, he owned four enslaved people, right? He enslaved four people to even make his little subsistence farm work. And when I looked at the wills and the estate settlement, all of his worldly possessions when he died in 1818, 70% of those assets were tied up in four enslaved people, right? That's how much invested in enslaving other human beings. And this is the same family tree that has Baptist ministers. And so all of this is like very much compatible with what it meant to be a good, upstanding Christian. There was like, you know, no tension really there.
Now we continue a conversation about white supremacy in family histories and in Christianity. I spoke with two authors about the past and today at this year's Wisconsin Book Festival. Here's the second part of our conversation. You both tell stories, most of them, maybe all of them, rooted in the South. And we really need to talk about the idea that racism, white supremacy, this is not a Southern issue. This is an American issue. This is a human issue. Robbie, how do we begin to think about that? How do you pitch something when your book has deep Southern roots to people here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, I would say that what you said is exactly right. I mean, this is an American problem, you know, and while my book has a kind of memoir, you know, anchor to it, I do kind of broaden the lens a bit. And it's important to note that this too, that like that every Protestant denomination of any size split over the issue of slavery in the Civil War, right? So the Methodist split, the Presbyterian split, the Episcopalian split. It's not just sort of Baptists in the Deep South, but they kind of split into Northern and Southern factions. And it's also to note that there is, you know, plenty of evidence that this is also not just a Protestant issue, that even in Catholic churches in New York, for example, as late as the 1940s, we're requiring African-Americans to sit in the back, only receive Eucharist after white members, you know, had received the Eucharist, had segregated the Catholic schools so that if you were an African-American, you couldn't go to necessarily go to the parish school that was most close to you. You had to go to St. Mark's. That was the Catholic school that you had to go to. So, and I think the bigger evidence for this is, and when I looked at current public opinion data and look at a whole range of attitudes, what we see is that this connection between Christianity and holding racist attitudes isn't only strong among white evangelicals, which are a more Southern expression, but you're in Wisconsin, right? So one of the larger expressions there are mainline Protestants, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, United Church of Christ, like those groups. But they score in the book I developed what I call a racism index, and scales were 1 to 10, with 10 holding the most racist attitudes across a range of 15 different questions, 1 holding least. White evangelicals score 8, but white mainline Protestants, that group that's more populous in the Midwest, score 7 out of 10 on that racism index. And white Catholics score 7 as well. So they kind of cluster up there, holding more racist views. And even when I control for region, urban versus rural, those kinds of things, this relationship still holds up. So it's not just driven by Southern culture. It's not just driven by urban or versus rural. Or the connection is between being Christian and holding more racist attitudes, because that relationship isn't there among whites who are not Christian.
What do you, Edward, think about this being more widespread than some of the stories that you tell that happened in the South?
Well, I have a pet theory that the South taught the rest of the country how to behave with respect to race. Most of the African Americans in the United States have an ancestral root in the Deep South. Once African Americans left the Deep South and began to inhabit the northern cities and the West, and the White South had perfected the system of segregation and the psychological life of alienation between whites and blacks. And it was as though we conveyed or educated or tutored the rest of the country how to act with respect to African Americans. It would be a self-deception to say that the great people of Wisconsin or Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota are unaware or colorblind and do not think or make decisions on the basis of race. Quite a lot of us as parents spend a lot of time thinking about where our children are going to go to school. Quite a lot of us as homeowners spend a lot of energy thinking about where we're going to buy a house. And quite a lot of us are working in relationships in our workplace with African Americans, but have no black friends and see no black people in our lives until 9 a.m. on Monday morning. So it's a kind of realism that I would like to encourage, which is a sort of self-assessment among white people about where we are psychologically in relationship to African Americans.
To kind of add maybe just a religious layer on the top of this, there's a similar, I think, way I talk about this in the book is that, you know, so I talk about my, you know, upbringing in the Southern Baptist Convention, this slaveholding convention built specifically to legitimate clergy, in particular, owning slaves. But it's notable that that denomination doesn't stay some fringe denomination once it breaks off. But by the 1950s, in the middle of the 20th century, it becomes the dominant expression of Christianity, bar none. It's the largest Protestant denomination of any kind by the middle of the 1950s and the 1960s. And so in the same way, I think Edward's talking about it kind of diffusing throughout the culture. I think that Southern Baptists really did that within religion. They diffused this way of being religious and this kind of views of white supremacy that then get spread, right, I think, into other areas. And the other just quick layer I'd add, too, is that when we ask a lot about how do we think about schools, how do we think about where we live, you know, the other question we can ask is well, how do we think about where churches got built, you know, and for whom? And so, like, if every white church, for example, ask an honest question about why is our church where it is, you're very going to get to some issue of race and racial discrimination, real estate redlining, white flight to the suburbs. Those issues are going to come forward very, very quickly.
Robbie, you tell the story of your great-grandfather who died in a mining accident, and a black man was blamed for his death. You remind us that the mine was dangerous, and then you write, I can only assume that both he and his family wondered as he left for work each day whether a misstep with his white coworkers or the wrong encounter on the road might be more perilous than the mine. And I mean, I have to say, I'm privileged. I do not feel this way. Black women, black men, black families, they talk about this feeling today in this moment that black people are not safe when they leave their homes. They're not safe even in their own homes. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's right. And I think part of wrapping our heads around, you know, wanting to have a country where that's not true, right? Wanting to have a country where Black parents and white parents don't have to have different talks with their children. But having that burden of having to think about, you know, a society that's structured to put you at risk in a way that it is not structured to put people who look like me or Edward at risk, right? I mean, I think this is the goal, right? And but we have to realize that if we're ever going to make a headway on deconstructing and building that society, we have to realize that we built it. I think we've got an opportunity here to really deconstruct this in a way that we perhaps have not had in front of us, certainly in my lifetime.
We've only scratched the surface of the ideas and the evidence that you provide in these books. Robbie, I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It was lovely to be here.
And Edward, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Kaylee.
That was my conversation with Edward Ball and Robert P. Jones. Robbie wrote the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And Edward is the author of Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. I spoke with them as part of the virtual Wisconsin Book Festival in October.